Okay, so I'm going to do a little bit of repeating just because we've got some new folks coming in. We have the videotape now going. My name is Matthew Cox. I'm one of the teaching fellows for the class. I work here at the university. This week has been crazy because of the snow, so normally in regular schedule we would have the lecture first and then the section and then the section lab. Tommy has filmed the section and it is up online, but there is another section that is going on at 7:30 this evening. Yes. And it's in Boylston Hall, which is this building right next to Widener Library, and we are up here in Maxwell Dworkin. So if after this you're interested in going to the section, that'll be run at 7:30 in Boylston. I am relying on the folks here to kind of drive us a little bit. I have Tommy's section materials. I have some of Dan's resources from the lecture, so we can go into those in depth wherever anybody needs some assistance, but we can also just kind of go through them generically. How many people have actually seen the lecture yet for this week? So we've got a little bit of lecture covered. All right, so is there any particular thing we want to start off by discussing? We've already had a couple questions about the project and where to go for some interesting sources of information. Okay, so let me go. I have Tommy's slides, and we'll be seeing them again in the lecture, the taped section that already is out there. In the first class, Dan made mention of some of these extra attributes that you can add to HTML files, which will have various behaviors on the mobile devices. For example, if you have an iOS device, you're probably familiar with the, you know, you go to a website that you like and you say, add to the bookmarks, add to the home screen. And what you get on the home screen is a nice little icon that is custom done for the site itself. It's not a generic bookmark icon. These are examples of how you accomplish that using, you know, just extra metadata in your HTML files. Specifically, you know, Apple Touch icon tells the browser, this is the icon for the site. When it gets saved to your, you know, iOS device home screen, that's the icon that gets used. By default, that will add a little gloss effect, a little beveling that everybody's familiar with. And if you don't want that on your icon, or if you have another icon created that has a different effect on it you prefer, you can provide this tag, Apple Touch icon precomposed, which just says, I've already set up this icon to do what I want. Don't mess with it. Take it exactly as it is. Yes?
Does the image have to be in a PNG format? Or?
I believe it does. The question was, does the image have to be a ping? I'm pretty sure that it does. Particularly Safari. I'm not as familiar with Chrome, how that does that on the Android, but Safari is very particular. It's also particular about how the files are named. I believe that, you know, the suggestion is you always name it icon.ping. So I believe that it does need to be a ping. You'll find that with a lot of, when we get to iOS as well, that using pings gives you a lot of flexibility, particularly with transparency, if you're using them in UI elements. So having transparent pings is very helpful. JPEGs are not going to work as well. And with GIFs, the color handling is not going to be what you hope it to be. So going with pings is not a bad way to go. Dan mentioned some of these, you know, how to adjust the viewport so that when it's displayed on the device, the zoom level is where you want it to be. And this is one that I'm not as familiar with, but believe what it does is it hides the address bar, makes your page look a little bit more like an application. And mobile, this changes the bar style to make it look black. You can see a lot of these if you go to the jQuery mobile interface demos. They have a lot of good examples of this sort of interface, and they're accomplishing a lot of those things using these various meta tags and then a lot of JavaScript after the fact. CSS tricks. These are useful as well. For this example, if you don't want user to be able to copy and paste the data out of the site. This would be the way that you would apply that, and on CSS styling for that particular div or the element that you wanted to block out. So again, all of these things are just kind of ways that you can make your mobile site behave a little bit more like a mobile application, or native application, I should say, on the device. Some of the advantages of using something like jQuery to do this is that you have one library that kind of will do all this stuff for you. You don't have to do it individually, but here, these are some examples of how to do that. Again, we mentioned gradients last week. That's how you do, you know, color fills on block elements, border radius, making things rounded. And these are CSS3 transforms. How you can do, you know, mathematical transforms on devices, or on block level elements, manipulating them in various ways. So there's also some animations that you can apply. Some of these things can be very complicated. These are all very simple examples of some of this stuff. So I think inset text. Well, I'm going to skip over some of this stuff so we can get to an actual example. So here's the URL that Tommy gave for the CSS example. I have this code up here. So we can see right at the top in the head, we have some meta elements with some additional data, which, you know, we're setting the viewport, saying it's not scalable. Set the device width, you know, the width of the viewable space to be the maximum width of the device. And then there's a couple other things saying that, you know, this is web app capable, so we can hide that browser bar. And we're changing the style of this bar to black. Then we have some normal CSS stuff here. Again, you'll notice we have a CSS style here with a gradient fill on the back. So we can bring this up in Safari on my Mac here. And we can see there's that gradient fill right there. Also has rounded corners. So if we switch back to the CSS, we'll see the border radius of 10 pixels.
So you have options on your page so that you can have it, like, if you're reading it on iPhone versus looking at it normally, is it on the page? Or is it only like sending to a separate page?
So the question was, is there a way to have options on the page? And I believe the intent is to style differently for different browsers. So generally, the way you accomplish that is using user agent detection. So you detect the browser string to make it behave differently. So you can tell the difference between a browser that is, you know, Safari on the Mac, Safari on Windows, versus Safari on iPad, iPhone, et cetera. So there's once you've done that sort of detection, you can do something with JavaScript to load different style sheets. You can do, you know, direct DOM manipulation and say, you know, okay, I've detected this is an iPhone. I want to do this to these elements. Keeping the styling separate from the content, probably what you do is have different style sheets for different browsers. And then once you detect the browser agent, you apply the style sheet that you're interested in applying. So, you know, mobile versus your main browser.
Is it appropriate to do that on the server side? So you just have a different web page that the server gives out for each different device?
So if you're, the question is that appropriate to do on the server side, have different pages? So you can certainly do that. If you have dynamically generated content, you're using something like PHP or some other server-side technology, you could do user agent detection there and spit back perhaps the page with a different style sheet included in it. Generally, the reasons for not doing that have to do with caching. If you wanted to, you know, cache the page, and have the page, when it's loaded by the client, do the right thing and load the right data remotely versus dynamically generating that page on every time it's fetched. So there are trade-offs there, and it would really depend on the application which way you'd want to go. Certainly, that's another way of accomplishing that. So in this example, this is a useful thing just to point out. In Safari, I believe under Advanced, I'm pretty sure this is on Windows as well as Mac, you can turn on the Develop menu, which is this very helpful menu here. And you can change your user agent string. Let me get back here. So I was in the Preferences and under Advanced. So there's a little checkbox down here at the bottom which will turn on that Develop menu, which is very helpful. Chrome has a similar Develop mode.
Can you show how you got that again? I'm sorry.
Preferences?
Wrong moment.
Yep.
Preferences. Okay, and then you went to
Advanced. And then show Develop menu in menu bar. All right. Sure. So with that enabled, you can change your user agent string. So by default, it's just going to be, you know, Safari for Mac, but you can change that to be one of the mobile browsers. This is a good way to see if a site behaves differently when it's loaded on a mobile device. This one won't. It will just do the exact same thing. Also, I have the simulator up. And we can see that you know, looks exactly the same there. You'll note that as soon as this gets loaded, the address bar disappears, and that goes back to the Apple mobile web app capable. So that is the bit that causes it to hide the address bar when the page is loaded. Sure.
To get that simulator, I guess you need to download the iOS simulator, and then do you need to register with Apple?
The question is, how do you get the iOS simulator installed on your Mac? I believe there's instructions posted on the site. You do need to register with Apple to have a developer, an ADC, log in.
And then we would use Harvard University as, to be able to register for free, we would be able to use.
So you don't have to register. There's no cost to having an ADC login. Okay. So you should be able to use your email address to create your own ADC account and download Xcode and the iOS SDK, and there's no cost. There's a cost to register for the iOS developer program and the Mac developer program. And what that gets you in addition to the tools is the ability to sign and publish an application to the App Store. Okay. So if at the end of the class you want to publish an iOS application and sell it in the App Store, the way to do that is you pay Apple the $99. For the purpose of this class, all you need to do is download Xcode and the SDK and install it, and that will include the simulator. I don't believe so. I think you only need to have an ADC account. So if that's wrong, I apologize. But I believe the instructions on the site are pretty straightforward. If you're paying money, probably you've gone down the wrong path. And that would be a good point to step back and make sure you don't pay money for something you don't have to and ask a question if you get down that path. But I don't believe you have to pay to just download the SDK. And the iOS simulator is one of the applications that is installed as part of that massive download of Xcode and everything else. Sure.
Is the editor also part of it?
No, this is just a free text editor that I downloaded.
Okay. Do you recommend that?
The question being, what editor do we recommend? And there's a pretty good discussion going on about this at Help CS76. So for this project, I probably would just use any text editor that you're very comfortable with. Text Wrangler is a good one on the Mac. Smalltron is another one, although I think development is no longer ongoing on this. The question was asked, should we use an IDE for this project? And I probably wouldn't recommend it just because it's not complicated enough of a project. You're doing kind of HTML and JavaScript stuff, so you're probably best off doing a text editor so you can really see what you're doing. An IDE will probably offer you a lot of bells and whistles, but may also complicate your life in ways that you're not expecting. When we get to Android and iOS development, there will basically be IDEs for each of those that you will kind of have to use. For Android, you'll use Eclipse, which is a Java-based IDE, which has been around for a long time and many people are used to using. For iOS development, you will use Xcode. Again, mainly the advantage of using those two tools is that it is a lot easier to work in the entire environment, and there's some tools for doing generation of UI elements and integrating them with your code base and all this sort of stuff that will become very important. And also, you'll be able to build and deploy into the simulators. So there's a simulator for Android applications. There's a simulator for iOS applications. We've seen the iOS simulator here, and the IDE environment will allow you to compile and put your code right into the simulators for testing, including normal sort of debugger capabilities. So you can interrupt on callbacks that you generate from the simulator by clicking on things and so on. For this project, again, basic text editor probably going to do just fine. If you're using Windows, I would make sure just don't use something like WordPad, because that's not really a text editor. That will let you do all sorts of styling that will probably get in the way of your code. And similarly on the Mac, TextEdit will do plain text files, but will also do RTF, which is a styled format that you probably don't want to use. Okay, carrying on. So we have gone through the styles. So JavaScript. Tommy feels very strongly about JavaScript. JavaScript is a very flexible language, has a lot of things going for it, and there's a lot of projects doing really cool stuff with JavaScript. I probably am not as feeling as strongly about it as Tommy does, but there are a lot of really cool things going on with JavaScript. jQuery is a great example. There's some other projects like Node, where they're implementing client-server implementations, both sides being written in JavaScript. It's lightweight. It's what's driving a lot of the enhancements in browsers. You'll see a lot of things about, the latest version of Firefox, the 4.0 betas, they're doing a lot of work on their JavaScript engine. That's because a lot of the things that, is Web 2.0 are really being driven by this language. So it is very cool. It is very powerful. Maybe it's the best programming language. That's all I'll say about that. Client-side scripting, there is some server-side stuff going on, but for the purposes of this class, it's sufficient to think of it as client-side only. Your code may be hosted on a server, but it's being delivered to someone's browser, and the code is running on their laptop, their mobile device, whatever it is. So it's not running on your server. It's running on the client side. It's not Java. Bad naming history going on there. Syntactically, it's familiar to a lot of language. It'll be familiar to other languages you'll have experienced. C and PHP, the control structures are very similar. The main difference, as mentioned here, are there's no type on the variable. You can see x is just 5, but that could be x equals quote 5, and then it would be a string. But also the functions have no return types, which is definitely different from C or Java or PHP. The other thing that's important to note is the variable scope. So in the previous example, we just have x is 5, so that variable doesn't have a scope attached to it. That's assumed to be global. So you have to be very careful when you're declaring variables to think about the scope of them. If you use var, that's the way you scope a variable, it's the variable that you declare is scoped to the current function. This is also really very different from most other programming languages, where you can have a variable that only exists for one loop. My for loop has this private variable. It only exists for the length of that loop, and then it goes out of scope again and goes away. That is not the case with JavaScript, and if you reuse variable names, you can run into problems and unexpected side effects. So just keep that in mind as you're going through. I think Dan in the lecture recommended some tools like JSLint that will help you by being extremely complainy about the way you declare your variables and where you put them and how you do every little bit with them, but it really does mean well, and it will help keep in mind the idea of variable scope. It makes some recommendations, like put all the variables for the scope of this function right at the top of the function, which does help you know where all your variables are coming from, but it also kind of adds extra work on you as you're going along. So there's some trade-offs there that you can think about as you're going through. JavaScript tags. I think most of us will have encountered these in our lives in some way. The code goes inside a script or can be loaded with a source on the script. Stuff inside the body will be evaluated as the page loads. So as it is encountered in the processing of the page, the script will be processed at that time. Anything in the head will be evaluated before. So this is kind of where you would do your setup. Yes?
JSLint, is that a browser add-on or is it an independent?
I think it's an independent tool. You'd have to do a Google search and...
I don't mean to make you do it right now. It's just good to know if you know what you're talking about.
JSLint.com. There you go. Warning, JSLint will hurt your feelings. So there's an online tool to interface with this. Interesting. Okay, so going back to particular things about JavaScript, how familiar is everybody with JavaScript? Should we go through these things? We've got a kind of mens and mens over here. We've got a few more. We've got some nos. Okay, so we'll continue down this path. So arrays are very useful. In most languages, if you have an array, it has to have one singular type of thing in it, whether it is an integer or a string or some complex object. If you have an array of integers, it has to have all integers in it. In JavaScript, there's a lot of flexibility there. You can do kind of whatever you want. We'll note that, you know, these first three things are clearly integers, but then we have a 4 in quotes, which makes it a string, and then we have what is, you know, a double or a float here because it's got some sort of precision on it. And all of these things can coexist peacefully inside a JavaScript array, and everything will be okay. This, of course, does mean that you can shoot yourself in the foot by putting things into your arrays that are not what you expect them to be. And I believe we can go over some of Dan's examples of how that will go horribly wrong. But keep in mind, when you're putting things into your array is not going to convert that string to an integer. It's not going to convert this double to an integer. So you have to pay a little more attention to this stuff programmatically because the language is not doing it for you. Arrays are objects, so you have these functions that you call upon them. Push takes and puts an element onto the end of the array.
Okay, I was going to ask, what was at the end of the beginning?
Generally, push is at the end because there's pop, which takes off from the end, and there's shift, which takes off from the beginning. And I'm not sure if JavaScript has this, so I'm not even going to mention it. That there are some other languages have functions for pushing onto the front. Normally, it's called unshift. I'm not sure if that actually exists in JavaScript. So pop, taking the last element off, and then slicing, which is how you take a bit out of the middle or ends of an array programmatically. So arrays are zero indexed. So 0, 1, 2 give me the from the second index position, element 3, and 1 beyond it. So again, you know, arrays are objects. There are functions you call on them to do things with arrays. Hash tables. So hash tables are different than arrays. Hash tables are array-like structures where you have a key and a value that goes along with it. It's a very common programming concept. And in JavaScript, they are not the same as arrays. Some languages like PHP, you can index a hash table the same way you index an array. That's not the case with JavaScript. So be aware of that. So here's your hash table being defined as the key of name with a value of Tommy, rank with a value of 1. And hash tables are also objects. So this is important notation. This dot notation, this comes up a lot when you look at things like JSON, which is JavaScript object notation. The idea that an object is essentially a hash table with a key and a value, and you can get at the key here being occupation, and you can set its value directly this way. Compare that to this. They're interchangeable in JavaScript. They'll get you the same results. Okay, we can add functions to our object as well. So you can, this is an anonymous function here. So the function doesn't have a name. It's being declared in the scope of this TF object. And the function that just puts up a JavaScript alert that says done on it, and it's attached to the key of grade. So if you call, in this case, tf.grade, it will call this function that's stored here as the value, because that is the value for this key. That makes sense. Anonymous functions and callback functions, or defining callback functions as anonymous functions, we will see a lot in JavaScript. There's a lot of things with the browser where you will register a handler and you will say, basically, when this happens, call this subroutine over here. So this is a very useful concept to get your head kind of wrapped around. It'll come up again in both iOS and Android programming, the idea of registering a callback that says, call this bit of code when this event happens. This is important stuff. Sure.
JavaScript interpreter is one responsible for saying, oh, something happened, let me call the handler for that, or is that something that we all have to write?
The question is, are you as the programmer responsible for writing the handlers that call the callbacks, or does the interpreter do that? So I think it's better to think of it as there are objects that exists that may or may not be written by you that will have handlers that you can register callbacks to. So we'll see some examples if we get down to some of the HTML5 stuff, that you will register a handler with the browser for a particular type of event. And in that case, it's the JavaScript engine that is going to call off your handler when the event occurs. But it's better to think of them as being attached to an object rather than attached to the JavaScript engine itself. There are a very simple example would be, say, I'll set an alarm for 10 seconds from now, and when that happens, do this thing. And that's the JavaScript engine in your browser that's going to basically say, oh, okay, at 10 seconds, I'll fire off this bit of code over here. But again, it's really better to think of that as kind of a generic object that exists. Other questions? Sure.
Are there any other scripting languages like JavaScript? This is like the only one.
The question is if there are other scripting languages. So there are all sorts of scripting languages. In this context, in terms of web browsers, no, JavaScript is kind of the game here, because it's implemented in the browsers. It's kind of become a de facto standard. I believe at one point there were other scripting languages, but it's been a long time since any of those were in existence. So in terms of scripting languages within the context of the browser, no, JavaScript is really the game. You can look at something like Microsoft and their ActiveX as its kind of client side, in that you have an embedded thing on the that gets loaded by the client and runs some code and calls back to the server, or a Java servlet container, which is or the same sort of thing where the server delivers Java code that gets loaded on a web page and run inside the browser. But both Java and ActiveX in that context are really relying on software being loaded into the browser. So with Java, it's the Java plugin. If you don't have the Java plugin to register, you know, this bit of Java code to run in your JVM on your laptop, none of that's going to happen. whereas JavaScript is really running inside the browser itself, so it doesn't need any additional software, which is really kind of why it's become so ubiquitous for this purpose, because it's built into the browser. You don't have to add extra software. You don't have to configure it and rely on the client to have it maintained for you. JavaScript will work. There's all sorts of things that you can prevent happening that might be features that are turned off in JavaScript, but I mean, as far as that goes, JavaScript is really the game there. Okay, so we have anonymous functions being added to the objects. This is another notation that's very useful. So this is our hash table from before. And for each variable I in the hash table, which in this case is going to give us the keys. So if we go back, we have a key of name. We have key of grade. For each key, you can think of this as key I. And then we're just doing a little string here to say, what's the value? So this is the value. This is the key. This is a nice way to loop over something that you have in a JavaScript object or a hash table in the circumstance to. There's a lot of data structures you will run into when you're getting data out of APIs. And there will be some of them will be better documented than others. So referring back to our previous example we talked about before we got started about the weather service. So there's going to be lots of documentation about the data you're going to get returned back from your weather service. And if you know specifically the thing you're looking for and you know the key of that is temperature, for example, then you can go straight to, you know, my weather object's temperature and you can get the value out. If there's a lot of complexity in the object as it's returned, this is a good way to kind of just loop over it and say, well, what data am I getting back? Am I getting the data I thought I'm getting back? Why am I getting bad answers? Why am I getting null? Why am I looking up, am I looking up something that doesn't exist? So this is a very useful thing for just kind of looping over objects or arrays or hashes. Okay, so we're making a callback here to the meta tags that we showed on the. I'm going to go back to the simulator here, so we can break up all that text and we can look at something happening again. So the that address bar hiding that we have going on there. So one of the things that's kind of suboptimal, I guess, if you have a mobile application and you're using the iOS device or the Android device is that for some of this functionality just to happen right out of the box, that address bar disappearing, for example, you have to have your user to save to their home screen, and then when they run it from the home screen, it'll come up with that stuff already hidden. And then it will look a lot more like an application, where when you load it directly, as we just saw, there's a little bit of a delay before that happens. And that's one way in which you're clearly not using a native application. So some of the tricks you can do are to use JavaScript to make that happen. So this is what I mentioned just a minute ago about setting a timeout with the callback. So you're setting a timeout, and you're saying, here's the function I want you to call. We're going to tell the window to scroll to this position. And we're going to do it at this time, which is 100 milliseconds. So we're registering a callback for something, some bit of code to happen at a particular time. In this circumstance, we're going to hide the window. We're going to scroll up a little bit so we get the most amount of screen real estate, because that's going to take up a lot of your display on these devices. Off the top of my head, I don't actually know. Okay. So I believe these are going to be coordinates inside the visible region of the document. So that address bar at the top is not part of your document. It's part of the application. So I believe what this is literally doing is saying, scroll to basically one pixel in X, which forces it to scroll down to that visible region. So that's just that's a bit of a trick to say, scroll to the visible region of the document, which will cut off the address bar, which is not part of your document. It's part of the application. You're going to get that out of the way. I believe this, you know, this again is the generic window object. So this stuff is going to be documented in your APIs for JavaScript. But I'm reasonably confident that's what that is doing. So now we get to jQuery, which I mentioned is one of those really cool projects that's going on with JavaScript, where we're building, you know, libraries being built with a lot of functionality in it. This is a really useful library. It's being used on a lot of dynamic websites and builds together a lot of great ways to get into the DOM where you previously would have been navigating through there by hand. Here's an example of that. This is kind of the way you get elements out of the DOM tree. You call the document and you say, hey, document, give me the elements. Or element in this case where the ID is this string. So you can tag something in the document and then you would fetch it out of the document using JavaScript this way. Now jQuery kind of hides all that functionality in this magical little dollar sign function, which lets you call directly onto objects. This is like all jQuery is going to be just like that. I'm not quite sure how I zoomed. There we go. Yes, it will definitely get quotation marks. The question is, will the selector that's being passed to this function call have quotation marks around it? And the answer is yes. So, for example, here we are for some examples. So, you know, selecting all the paragraph elements, all images that have the CSS class of logo. This is a nifty little trick. Not everything that has navbar. And this is another nifty trick to say, okay, we'll get all the list elements and then all of the even children of those list elements. So you can imagine all sorts of ways you can slice apart bits of data out of the page and do some really interesting things. Again, here we have this idea of event handling, binding callbacks to events. So in this circumstance, we are taking all image elements. Again, this is selecting is going to give us all the image elements. We're going to bind on the click event. And with that click event, we're going to call this, again, this anonymous function here, which is going to pop up a JavaScript alert that you've clicked on an image. So again, because this jQuery is going to return all elements that are of type image, this one line is going to do it for every image on a page. Could get ugly, but could also be extremely powerful. Yeah. I mean, if you only wanted to do this to one image and then you had 100 images on your page, then yes, you could make it such that anything your user clicks on would get an annoying pop-up. But if you wanted to apply a transform an example is, if you think of an iPhone application, you hit that edit button and then every row in the field gets a little delete button on it. You can do the same sort of thing for your website. Every image gets a big X over it so that when you click on that X, you know to delete the image that the click event happened on. So there's all sorts of really powerful things you can do with very simple callbacks. So this is a note, bind takes two arguments, name of the event, in this circumstance, click, the click event, and the event handler, which again, this is anonymous function right here. DOM manipulation, after, I'll kind of skip over these. We'll see an example of this in a second, which will be a little more useful to think of. But you can think of it along these lines. For every element that exists in the page, there's a space before it and there's a space after it. And if you wanted to insert something before it in the page or after it in the page, these are the mechanisms you would use to do that. And you can also change the style right from the JavaScript. So or change the class, test if it has the class. There's all sorts of documentation on stuff you can do with jQuery. And here we are bridging the gap to back to the server side. So we're making, you know, this is an example of a GET request. So we get this page, and then as the result, when that page is loaded, we call this callback. Similarly for a POST request, sorry about that, we post to this URL, and when that POST goes through, we handle that. We call this callback. So here we go. This is the fun stuff. Let's go back here. Here's our jQuery. So let's look at the source code first. So basically, what we've got here is we've got our script tag that loads the jQuery library. In this case, we're loading it directly from jQuery. And this is the compressed JavaScript. And here are our functions. So down at the bottom here, we've got our paragraphs with IDs 1, 2, 3, and 4. And here we're binding some events to happen. So for paragraph, for, well, class ID 1, on click, the object itself, this, it's a common JavaScript notation for the object you're currently working on, this, you will hide, and this is a speed, how slowly or quickly it hides. And so we can go back here, and we can see basically here's that first one. If I click on it, it slowly rolls up and goes away. We can look at this code again for number 2. On click, change the CSS, set the color to be red and the background to be black. And we can already guess what the third one is doing because I keep moving my mouse over it. And basically, on hover, add the class big to it. And I think we can see up here in the CSS, big just sets the font size up to be 30 pixels. And again, since I've hovered over it a bunch of times, we can already guess what's going to happen there. Gets real big. And just for the last one, number 4, this is the example of, again, using that after. On click, this, add after it, a new paragraph. And that will be like that. And no limit to the number of times we can do that. And we can bring the same thing up in the simulator, and we can, you know, guess it's going to behave the same way. And wow, that's bad. Oh, I can't zoom. All right, I can zoom a little bit. Yep. So click. Oh, see, this is actually a useful thing to show, although it was not my intent, that in the simulator there are some events you can't get, which will tie into our next section of other events that are going beyond. There's no hover event on a touchscreen because you're hovering all the time, technically, and there's no way to measure that. So there's no hovering, but clicking, basically the same event. So how are we doing here? I feel like, get some voting, everything is still all right? Okay. So what it's actually doing is adding a CSS class. So we can see that there's two functions being passed to hover, and one is, I believe, on hover start. So when hover starts, it adds the class big, and when the hover event ends, it removes the class big. So it's not actually destroying the existing styling that is on that element. It is simply saying, add this class to it, and then we're getting the results of that CSS styling in this case. The question is if it will work if it already has a font defined. So there is no font specified, but we're only changing the font size.
I know, I was just wondering, so like if you had specified it to be 10, would it then override that 10 temporarily?
So the question is, if there was already a font size specified on the element, would this override it? I believe the answer is yes, because CSS styles are cascading, so they are applied from beginning to end. So in this circumstance, any previous font style would font size would be overridden by this class because it would be added latest in that tree. If the font size is already bigger than this, this would have the result of making it smaller. So if you had styled this event to be this element to be font size 50 pixels, this would not actually be making it bigger. It would be maybe making it smaller. But yeah, the last one wins out here.
Can you have it pick up what the current font is and like, pick it double it or something?
Yes, you absolutely could do that. I leave that as an exercise for you. Sure.
Cascading where a style attribute.
I still believe that this would override that. The question is if the distinction between a style that is loaded from a CSS and applied versus a style that is directly applied like this, whether or not that would be overridden. I believe that adding the class this way would still override it because that would be inserted last in that processing, but the only way to know for sure would be to try that out.
Would an ID still have priority over anything that was added?
Would an ID have I'm not sure I understand the question. So the ID in this circumstance is the way to identify the
identifier.
Right. So you could programmatically change the identifier this way, but then you would not be able to use the same callback again. But this is adding a class, not an ID.
No. So I'm saying if it already had an ID and you added the class to it, but the ID had a font size already.
So the yes. So you're saying if the ID was a identifier in the CSS that had a font size on it, yes, that is the exact same case that we're talking about. It's just a different way of, there's a bunch of different ways to put styles on elements. You could put them based on their type or their ID or their class, right? So, but they're all still processed in order of how they are applied from kind of, you know, top to bottom. I don't know off the top of my head. Again, I believe that this will always be getting applied last, so would override it. I'm seeing head shaking. So correct me. Tell me why.
I think he's right. There is precedence, and it has to do. It's very complicated, and I don't know all the answers.
So there are definitely some. Yeah. So there's definitely some. And to be fair, the specifics of that precedence may vary from browser to browser. Which I know to be the case for different sorts of styles. The other thing to keep in mind is whether a previous style has been flagged with, you know, important, which may affect your ability to override it. Just for the sake of argument, I will show the so the web inspector, which is going to be very hard to read on the video. But if you bring up the web inspector, there's a styles on the right-hand side here. And so we can see the styles as they are going upwards. So there's no particular, so I'm right now looking at the body. So let's do something more useful and look at, this is paragraph ID 2. Okay, so I've clicked on paragraph ID 2 here, and we can see there's a nice highlighting around it so we know which element we're clicking on. And we can see that here's what it's gotten from the P tag. It has being displayed as a block. It has this following margin on it. The style attributes on the object itself have been changed to be the background is black, the color is red, and the margin is 100 pixels, which is what we had from before. So the interesting thing that you can do here is you can turn off these styles, and they will affect the display in the browser live. But the most interesting thing is this very top one, which is the computed style, which has everything that is being that is factoring into the display of that current element. So from the browser's built-in styles for how it renders things to your own individual style. So for the sake of argument, if we reload this page and we go to paragraph 2 again, so we can see here style attributes, the only style attribute on it is this margin of 100 pixels right here. And the computed style has all this other stuff in it, which is coming from its block elements. But when we click on it, oh, look how tricky that is. It's not actually changing. Took away my magic. There we go. So it was not as cool as I thought it might be. It didn't insert it live into the DOM. What you're getting is by clicking on these elements, you're getting a snapshot of the view of the browser at that particular time. So it did not just didn't get right inserted in there, but when we click on it again, we can see those things have changed back to what they were. All right. So that's that code. So, okay. Mobile events. So this is where you start getting into stuff that only works in the mobile browsers. There are different types of events that are being defined for the mobile versions of WebKit that you can do nifty JavaScript stuff on. I'm not going to read through all of these, but they make a lot of sense. You know, when someone starts touching the screen, when they move their finger, when they lift off the screen. Gestures are when you have more than one finger on, so you can. That's where your pinch and your zoom comes in. So these are all events that only exist for the mobile versions of the Safari or WebKit browser in this case. Touch and gesture properties, pinch, zoom, scale, rotation. Yeah, sure. So the question is that pinch and zoom seems to be enabled by default, and the answer is yes. So the browser will have a pinch and zoom handler, which will zoom in on your page, or you've got the double tap handler, which is to kind of zoom in on that paragraph. So yes, the browser has, in this circumstance, default actions defined for those things. You can, of course, receive those events on the entire page, or you can receive them on individual elements in that page. There are ways to also disable that. So one of those meta tags we saw, which was disabling the user's ability to zoom. So that would remove that particular handler for that event. So you can't zoom in. Again, I think it's better to think of that the document object, the top level JavaScript object, has predefined handlers for some of these events. So what we're doing is overriding them by attaching events to more particular objects in the entire tree of objects. This is scale, rotation. Okay, so this is an interesting notation. This is a good note to notice for using jQuery versus one of the mobile variants of the jQuery libraries. jQuery is very general in that it implements the various events that it knows about for the browsers. But it will also let you bind to events it doesn't know about, because worst case scenario is the event never gets generated, so your code never gets called. But in this case, it allows you to bind to events that exist for mobile browsers that it doesn't know about specifically. So we're at this mobile example. So I think we can quickly go through this, and then we'll take a 5-minute break, and we can change tapes and come back and probably do some HTML5 stuff. But let's go to the mobile example. So here's events. So this is, make sure I'm doing this right. I'm going to put this back to default. So this is the normal Safari user agent browser, and there's this big green box, and we have bound some events to it. And you'll note that I cannot trigger any of these events because we have bound to mobile-only events, so I cannot generate them in my regular browser. If I switch over to the simulator, and I put the hardware here, oh, there we go. So now we've got the same green box, and now we can start generating events. Touch start, touch end, touch move. And a good trick to know for the simulator, if you hold down the Option key, you get two dots, so you can pretend to be two fingers on the touchscreen. So I can click, and I can drag them apart and scale, and I can rotate. And now I've done all sorts of things. So that's just a little preview of those events. Why don't we take a break, and we'll come back, we'll get into the code, and then we'll go more into HTML5 stuff. So in the break, we had a question raised just about where the stuff is that I'm looking at right now. All of this stuff is available off of Tommy's site, and the URL is there. And
will this PDF be available at some point as well?
I believe that is up there. The PDF is up there. Then I will ask Tommy about that. Put this on the website so we can link to it. So let me follow up with Tommy after he actually runs the section tonight, because I'm not sure exactly how he is planning to disseminate this information, but I will make sure that it ends up somewhere so that we can get to it. But if you wanted to follow along for the last little bit here, that's where I am looking right at the moment in terms of the code base. So, okay, right before the break, we had, I'm going to zoom this back down, shown some of the mobile-specific jQuery events. We have the Option key here with the two fingers. Now we're going to look at what that code looks like right here. So again, we have some of our mobile-specific metas. We have just our style for our big green box. And we're getting the jQuery library from a different place this time, from Google, seemingly for the AJAX portions of it, although we're not using any of that stuff. So again, what we have here is our jQuery scripts. This is our document object. This is our function to be called when the document is ready. And here we have our various events. What does the hash do? I'm sorry?
The hash action.
So this is a CSS selector. Or this is a more specifically. No, this is a CSS selector on our div. The ID is action. So we've got two divs, one with an ID of action, one with an ID of info. And then we're doing something tricky because we're binding on things of style box here. So this is our big class box that we're registering our events on. And these are two divs we are selecting by their ID, and we're putting information into them. Okay, so this is just our normal ID-based CSS selector. So again, here we have our box. We're binding on the event touch start with the function callback that says get the div by ID that has the ID action and set the text to be touch start. So we'll just, let's go back here and refresh this from beginning. So you can see those, there are two divs up here that don't have any content in them right now. And we have our big green box. And as soon as we start a touch event, it inserts text into that div that previously had nothing in it. So that's what we've done there. And all the rest of these are going to look very similar to that. Again, on the box, we're going to bind on touch move, and we're going to change, you know, the text of the element with the ID action have this text in it. Same thing for touch end, gesture start. Gesture change is where we're doing something different. And this is where we get back to that two finger pinch zoom action there. We have the action div is set just to gesture change, but then we have the info, the element with the ID info has HTML content in it that is the scale, which we can see this is taking an argument here, which is the event. So this is different than the ones up here, which are taking no arguments. This one is taking in an argument of E, which is the event. And from that object, we're calling the original event. We're getting the scale, the value of the scale. Similarly, after adding a break tag, rotation, the original event, and we're getting the value of the rotation. And then at the end of the gesture, we're setting the action div back to gesture end.
So what's the difference between gesture and touch? Is gesture when you put two fingers on?
Yeah, so the question is the difference between gesture and touch. Touch is one finger, gesture is two or more fingers. Right now, I think gestures are going to be limited to two fingers, but there's already some future versions of iOS we've seen where they're having multi-finger gestures. Also on the iPad, you can have different combinations of fingers. You can get multi-touch information better.
Sir? Over again, the difference between just the E for event and E.original event?
So the E is the event object, and probably in some raw format. In there is another object named the original event, and it has these following attributes on them. You'd have to refer more specifically to the jQuery documentation, but my guess is that jQuery is in some way wrapping around the kind of native JavaScript event object. So how you know to be these particular things is to look at the documentation. I've skipped all that and gone directly to Tommy's nice figuring out. But the jQuery documentation is quite good and quite extensive. In this circumstance, these are the two things we're interested in. I think there was mention of the slides, but I would say refer to the documentation there.
And so it's the comma dot box. Is there something before the dot that's assumed? Or what's the notation
there? Dot is, the question is, what is dot box referring to? Dot box is referring to, again, this is just a CSS style selector, so that's a CSS class. And that just is referring, here's the definition of the CSS style for dot box. And then down here in the actual body, we have a div that has been assigned the class of box. So dot is just the CSS selector for class, much like hash is the CSS selector for ID.
And none of those actions would work unless you do the bind gesture function.
Right. If you don't bind, these will not be called. And again, what's again to differentiate a little bit between the kind of what we mentioned as being the default handlers of these events versus our own particular handlers, we are binding specific handlers to this div. So theoretically, if the page was big enough and the div was small enough, you could still pinch and zoom on other parts of the page and it wouldn't hit these callbacks. It's only specifically when you are triggering these events on this div that we're going to hit our callbacks. So we can register events like this on anything as small as, a character in a particular paragraph if you wanted to, if it had a class associated with it, versus the entire document as itself. So you could have different events happening in different areas.
Would it still scale the page that enlarges the other parts of the page that scale as well or not, since it has different actions?
Yes. The question was, would the page itself also scale? And yes, in this circumstance, no, because I can only... So we can see I'm triggering some events here that are not clear. Oh. But as soon as that is going inside of my div, it's calling my handlers. And see if I can, I can't actually manage to trigger it outside. But I mean, that's a byproduct of this particular div taking up all the visible space and may, let's refer back to just one second. User scalable is also set to no. So that is also preventing me from zooming the rest of the page around the div. But yes, theoretically, you could zoom other parts of the page, not hit these callbacks, only hit these callbacks when you're doing those events right on that element.
Is there a way to connect your phone and test it on your phone?
The question is there a way to test this on your phone? Yes, absolutely. This, so not in the way you're thinking, I suspect. So if I attach my phone to my laptop, there's no way for me to literally test this exact file from my laptop onto my phone. Of course, what I've actually, the way that this is working is I'm serving this out. There, I have a web server set up on the laptop and it's serving it out, and that's how I'm viewing it in the simulator. So if I open that port up, I could view that port on my phone. I could go to the web server using my phone, and then I could test it that way. Because basically all we're doing is viewing it in a browser. So in that way, yeah, you can test anything you can load in a browser on your phone. If there is some interest about how to do that on a Mac, you just have to turn on web sharing, and then the built-in Apache web server will be turned on, and by default it's serving things out of your home directory and then the sites folder. So everything I'm doing on the Mac, I'm not doing anything super complicated. These are just plain HTML and CSS, so there's no server-side processing, so I've just turned that on.
Can you access that through your phone then?
If I had my firewall open, then I would visit the URL that it's helpfully giving me right here, which is going to be really hard to read, but on your own computer, it would be something different. Over the network, yes. Mm-hmm. So if your phone and your computer are on the same network and you have your firewall open, yes, you can access that port directly from your phone. So your own host name will be different. It will vary depending on what network you're connected to at the time. But my firewall is not allowing access to that, so I cannot show it to you on my phone, nor can you show it to yourself on your phone. I'm sorry. So where would I, that was under sharing. I had this open, just prepping for the next stuff. So that's the end of Tommy's slides. So that's going to be the end of the JavaScript jQuery part of this for right now. We're going to move on, and we're going to start going through some of Dan's HTML5 stuff. Does that make sense? Okay. So here's what we have for Dan. So Dan asked that I go over more specifically this final combination of stuff. So really watch the lecture, because Dan is going to go through and build up to this final project. I'm going to skip forward a little bit and go right to the end. He has some code examples for doing data storage using HTML5 and some manipulation using JavaScript. Then he has an example for doing geolocation using HTML5 with some manipulation with JavaScript. But I'm going to jump straight to the end where he combines the two of those things together, gets the peanut butter and the chocolate mixed in, and then we do something that's tasty. So I'm going to open this page in my Safari browser to make the point about location. This is something to keep in mind when you're doing programming. So there's a lot of features of HTML5 that can be disabled by the user. So you really have to programmatically think about what happens if the user says, no, I don't want this web page to know where I am. So this is what happens when your user loads the browser and you say, can you tell me where you are in the world? And they could say, no. And then we have JavaScript that's hopefully letting us know that it has been refused. But these are things to think about. I've seen pages from very large brand company websites that don't handle this particularly well. They're expecting to be able to get your location, and they're expecting to be able to store data on your computer. And when you tell them no, things blow up and just don't work at all. And it's okay if you expect that and you say, hey, because you said no, this is not going to work. It's probably less okay if you just completely fall down and your site just doesn't do anything any longer. So these are things to keep in mind. And I will point out that on Mac laptops under security, there's this checkbox here labeled Disable Location Services, and you can turn this off on your entire laptop. So even more specifically than in the browser, you can say for my laptop, I don't want anybody being able to do this, and you can turn this off right here. Also, if we go into preferences on Safari, under security, there is a similar box here. Allow websites to ask for location information. So there's a couple different ways to turn this stuff off, and then there's, you know, the way I just showed you, which is just when asked, do you want to let this happen, you just say no, and then it fails. So there's a few different ways, particularly on Macs, where this can be turned off. It is worth noting that my desktop Mac does not have this option under security. I believe this is a laptop-specific thing for Apple. And I have no doubt there's similar features in Windows, but I have no idea what they are, so I'm sorry I can't point you more specifically. But just as a developer, be aware of the fact that these things can be turned off, and you should try to handle them as gracefully as you can. And from an iOS point of view, let's see. Oh, I don't have that open. Let's go back. I apologize for this. Okay, here we go. So, as an iOS developer, you will also be asked a similar question. I've already said yes to this today during my own testing, but on the iPhone device, I'm sure you've seen this if you've used an iPhone and you've installed an application that's asked for your location, you get a little dialogue that says, you know, this application would like access to your location, yes or no. And then there's a way you can turn that back on and off in the general settings. So even on, you know, the mobile devices, there's an opportunity for the user to say, no, don't track me.
Question?
Yep.
Is there a way in the emulator to lie about your GPS coordinates for purposes of testing?
So my experience with the simulator, the question is there a way to lie to the emulator so it has a position? My experience with the simulator is as follows. It will use the position of your laptop. In this circumstance, it will know that we're in Cambridge. We'll see in a minute. It will, failing that, fall back to Cupertino, California as your location. So if you're using the simulator on the Mac Lab computers, it will probably tell you all the time that you are in California. On the Android platform, there is a way to use the simulator and feed it coordinates into the GPS through a complicated mechanism that I would probably avoid dealing with if you could at all possible, but it is possible to do. There is no way to feed the simulator on the iOS side a location. But if your device, your laptop in this circumstance, has the ability to have a location, then it will use that. And failing that, it'll say it's in California. So you will get data back as you pull. It just may not necessarily be as accurate as you intend it to be.
You can just boost the coordinates in the JavaScript, I would imagine. You just go in and hard code the coordinates. Is that possible? Or?
Yes, you could hard code the coordinates so that you always got a certain result. In this circumstance, what we're doing here is triggering based on the browser's idea of what your location is. So you would have to, instead of triggering on the browser's idea, you'd have to have another way to say, you know, for example, set a timeout so that every 100 milliseconds you call your own callback with a set of coordinates in it. So that would be one way you could fake it, not necessarily the most accurate way, but it would be a good way for testing your code. Just set something else to fire off your handler so you get some data back. All right, so what do we have here? So we have a few sets of HTML5 files and a little bit of JavaScript that is going to ask your browser via HTML5 to give it the location and then do some stuff with that with JavaScript. So we have this page. It's not recording because I said no. I'm not sure if this is going to work. This is not going to work in Safari for whatever reason. But let's look at the code because that's a little more interesting. Here we go. This is this record HTML. I will provide a URL to this later at the end of class. I'm sorry. So we have this HTML5 file. There's nothing particularly crazy about it. If we scroll past all the JavaScript and just go down here, what we have is normal kind of HTML5 body. There's an onload which is calling JavaScript. There's a few links to JavaScript. We have a div, and we have some links. So nothing hugely exciting here. This is basic HTML stuff. What's happening in that function that's called onload? Oh, so there's a few things happening. Let's just walk through them. So we have a variable that is our identifier for the position. So we can say, turn this off, turn this on. This is a variable, which I said we skipped over some stuff, but we have a variable for local storage. So we're going to create a variable. It's going to get stored in the user's browser. So even though I'm just a simple little HTML file, I'm not sending anything back to the server side for storage later, I'm going to have this variable that exists, and I can get data out of it. And then I'm creating a new array of the track. So this is going to be our positional data over time. The function that gets called on load is this geo function. First thing we do, local storage. So these, again, are going to be some specialized JavaScript objects that exist in the browser. Local storage is your kind of your vault for variables that get saved. So this is our, you know, our variable, and this is essentially what we're going to call. This is our key. This is our GPS track. This is what we want to call it. This could be my greatest variable ever, something unique that you know you can get back out of the local storage object. So first thing we're going to do is going to take it out. We're going to move that item. We're going to pass it this variable with our key thing in it. Say, take this out, throw away whatever is there. We're going to set some options for the accuracy, timeout for the geo. I'm going to go out in front of a question and say, how did Dan know that these are the options to set? And I'm going to guess that he looked at the HTML5 documentation. Off the top of my head, these don't necessarily mean anything to me. I mean, they're parsable. How he knew to set these is he looked at the HTML5 documentation, looked specifically at the location-based stuff. So we're setting high accuracy to be true. I'm not sure exactly what this means in terms of distance. The iPhone and Android in their own SDKs have some ideas of the level of accuracy. So you can say, I'm not interested in the information if the accuracy is low, because probably the data that you're getting back is too far away from where the person actually is to be useful. So we want to turn on high accuracy here. Hopefully that gives us the most specific information that we can use. So if you think of something like Foursquare, if your accuracy is low, you can be checking into a lot of buildings in, you know, 1,000 feet around you. What they're probably most interested in is the most accurate information they can about you, so they can say you're really inside this building, you're not within the block of that building. So this is how you would enable that feature. Setting a timeout. This is generally on the iPhone, particularly, you'll find when you get to the SDK, there are various things that can happen that your device will not return GPS data in a timely fashion. This can be an indicator of, well, I've had a bad polling window, I want to throw away this data, or maybe the information is not coming back because we've taken our phone and we've gone into a tunnel. So we should probably not have our program sit there and wait for GPS data if it's never going to get back. So again, just setting a timeout where we give up. Maybe we do something that says, okay, well, we've stopped getting information from you. We're gonna give up on the GPS for now. We're going to keep carrying on doing our other thing. Maximum age, probably exactly what it sounds like. What's the longest period of time before we get some new record? So we've got some options. Moving on. So navigator, geolocation, you know, test for this. We're testing if this feature is available. Sure.
The maximum age, that's you're going to keep polling. The timeout is greater than the maximum age, so we'll keep asking.
Maximum age is probably an option that says, don't give me data if it is already this old. Ask again. So if you're thinking of your mobile device, there's a GPS, there's a location service that happens on your mobile device. So it is getting information every set amount of time. And if it has, you know, a a previous program just asked for the location, and then you launch a new program, you ask for the location again. Is that location from the previous cache result still valid? Do you want me to ask again? Some of these choices can make a difference in terms of battery life. Probably assume you're not going too far with your phone in that amount of time. So I think that's what that's controlling, not necessarily the interrupt. Yep. Okay, so testing for the capability. Does the browser have the geolocation function? So again, if not, we throw up the alert. Not supported by the browser. Watch ID, we'll look back up here. This is our variable for keeping track of it so we can get rid of it. So we're registering a handler. You're assigned an ID from the browser to keep track of what's going on. Watch position. So this is a callback. Record geo is, what is record geo? Handler options. It's a function, yeah. There it is, it's down here. So watch the position, record geo is the name of our function down here. We're telling it this is our handler to call when the event occurs, and the options that we set up here that we just worked our way through. And here's our, this is the name of our function to be called when a valid event occurs, so we get some data. Handler is the name of the event to call when there's an error. So we can see that defined right down here. Handler error. So this is where we get all sorts of the cases I was just talking about. What happens when the user says no? What happens if the position is not available? Takes in an error object, and we're doing a switch statement just to handle through the various things. So yeah, stop geo. This is important on iOS devices. You'll see the same thing when you get to native applications. Stopping the location services, otherwise you'll continually get messages back from it, even though you may have given up on doing the recording. So does record geo do when it gets something back? So it has this position argument that comes in. It's an object of some sort. But first thing we do is we're going to get a timestamp. So we get there's a date object being generated off the timestamp on that recorded position. Then we're going to our document tree. We're getting our element geo, which again we see down here is just this div. It's got nothing in it when the page starts out. But as we start recording locations, we're going to start putting that information in a visible way so the user can see that. Setting the HTML. And here we are back at that position object. So we have coordinates, latitude, longitude, and accuracy. So this is where we're just displaying the data in the page. We're putting it into that div. Again, in terms of what these things specifically are, I mean, the labels make sense. Refer to the documentation for what information is contained inside that position object, but this is going to be the most obvious things you're going to use out of that object. Now, here's the other bit we're doing right here. So track, if we go way back, is our array. So we just have this array that we're using to put in positional information as we get it. And we're pushing onto it a hash table with key latitude, this value, longitude, the longitudinal value, accuracy. We're putting that into our array. But the last thing we're doing is we're saving that back into the local storage. So I mentioned the JavaScript object notation earlier, and that's exactly what this is doing. This is JSON stringify. So take this object, turn it into a string, and put it in the local storage. So the kind of nifty thing you can do with JSON is you can take a complex JavaScript object, you can turn it into a string value, which is all, you know, very useful for passing around via AJAX callbacks, for example, storing into local variables so you can get it back out. So it's a very useful thing. And the stringify function is what that's doing, saying take this object, turn it into a string, put it in the local storage at this key, which we've already defined up there. So
that only part of HTML5?
Is that only part of HTML5? No. So JSON is implemented in all sorts of languages.
The object itself.
The JSON object itself?
Yes.
That is a good question. I don't know off the top of my head. I don't see any other libraries being loaded, so I'm going to say yes. Everything else, all my other previous experience with JSON, you are using some library to provide that to you, whether it is jQuery or PHP or what other language you have. They have JSON implementations in them that allow you to have function callbacks to do this thing. Since there's nothing else being loaded here, I am going to assume that this is part of HTML5, but don't hold me to that because I'm not 100% certain. But I see no evidence of anything else being loaded, so I would have to go with yes. Sure.
Question.
Yep.
Is some kind of Google geocoding API being used in here, or
is any Google geocoding API? So no, because we're getting the information being reported to us by the browser. So we're not doing any geocoding. Geocoding, strictly speaking, is when you take coordinates, and reverse geocoding is you take coordinates and you turn them into a city. So you say, what are these coordinates? And you get back, Cambridge, Massachusetts. So that's reverse geocoding. But in this case, all we're literally doing is getting the coordinates as reported to us by the browser. So the browser is getting that information. But I don't believe Apple is using Google to get that done. The implementation may vary depending on what HTML5 browser you're using. I'm pretty confident that Apple is not using Google to get this done, though.
So where would that the location information be coming from? Is it based on the IP address? And what's doing the
with the circumstance of a laptop, the question is where is the GPS data coming from? When you're at a computer, the information is going to be IP-based. If you think back to the original iPhone that did not have GPS in it, Apple was actually using a service that the name is escaping me at the time, but one of the things they had done was map wireless networks, and then they had a way to determine not just based on your IP, but based on kind of the wireless networks that were nearby you, kind of roughly where you were. The iPhone 3G, 3GS, and 4 all actually have GPS chips in them. And in that case, the GPS data is coming from the GPS chips itself. But yes, and the my laptop doesn't have GPS in it, and yet this will still work. So it's doing some sort of GeoIP lookup on the back end somewhere.
Okay.
And there's all sorts of services that maintain those sorts of mappings and resell that information. And there's a bunch of different ways to do that. If you're interested in that, you want to do a Google search for GeoIP. There's all sorts of modules for PHP and JavaScript that'll take an IP address and give you back coordinates, much like this is doing. But we're kind of, by being able to use HTML5 for this purpose, we're completely hands-off from that. We don't have to do anything specific. We let the browser do the lookup and give us back the information that we can. Okay? And then this is just the function. We saw this above when we got an error to stop the tracking for any reason. So we're kind of coming to our last 15 minutes here. But let's go over to the simulator and do something useful. So that's probably going to be hard to read, but let me do this. Does that help? OK. So this is that HTML5 page. It's loaded up in the simulator. As I mentioned earlier in the day, I've already said OK. So I allowed this to read my location using HTML5. And this is our div right here where the data has been inserted. So we're roughly, you can see the accuracy here is 40 meters, which is, that's pretty good. I mean, I've seen better. But again, we're on a laptop. We don't actually have a real GPS device. So that's not too shabby. And if I stop recording, all right, stopped recording. How cool is that? So let's see what this looks like. Let's look at the raw data first. Oh, look, we've got multiple points which have gone off the screen. Let's see if I can get more of that on there. Oh, well, this is what we got. So this is our array that we put into local storage. So all this page is done which we haven't looked at the code for this page, but I can tell you what this page has done is asked the local storage object to retrieve the value that we've previously stored. So these are two separate HTML5 pages. There's no code interchange between them. What we have is we know there's a variable that we've set, and we've asked for the value back. And as we can see, the outermost brackets are square brackets, which is our array. But then inside, we have these curly braces, which indicate our hash table. And we can see our latitude that was previously displayed, our longitude, negative 71, and the accuracy of 38 meters. We can also see that we've recorded more than one position in here, because here's a second one starting up. And we can see, unsurprisingly, that in those two samples, my laptop has not moved. It's not changed IP. We've not gone anywhere else exciting. We've stayed in the exact same place. But it is important to note that we actually did get more than one sample. So that's the raw data. Let's go back and do something more useful, which is look at the track. So here we are. It knows we're in Cambridge. This is probably an interesting thing to look at, just to look at the code and how we did that.
Where's it showing that you are?
It's that red dot there. What, you can't see that? So we don't have like a big Google Maps style pin, but our location is marked on the map, and that's pretty close to where we are, really. So let's go back and look at that code. So again, here's show raw, we've got all this JavaScript stuff, but all we're doing is, you know, checking that local storage variable, make sure it's not null. If it's null, we just put this in there. We put an error message in there. But if it's not, if it actually has value, all we're doing is setting it, to be the content of that variable right there. So as I said, that's not exciting, except for the fact that you have this little persistent variable store that you've put something in, and you've retrieved it back out, and it's all been on the client side, and you really haven't done any heavy lifting at all. So I mean, that's pretty cool, but very simple. And then let's go over here to see what we're actually doing to get this out. And you can see we are not doing this in HTML5. We are actually using the Google Maps API.
Is this code available for us to look at?
Yes, all of Dan's code will be available. I'll put the URL up at the end of class, but also I believe it'll be mentioned in the lecture video where it is, but I'll put it up. So we can see we've got some options set up. We've set a zoom level. So Dan has hard-coded here a center point for the map's location. Again, you have to trust me, this is the Google Maps API. This is also documented like crazy. But we're making a center point that is a lat-long object with this latitude and this longitude, and I'm going to undo that. And we're setting the type to be a road map. Create the map object. Now here's where we do the stuff with the local data. So again, we retrieve this. Again, this is a JSON object, so we're going to turn it back into a JavaScript variable. Mentioned we had the stringify function on the previous file, and on this one we have got parse. So we're taking a string, we're parsing it, we're turning it back into a JavaScript object. We're making a line of coordinates. So again, if we were moving, theoretically we'd have multiple points and you'd connect those points on a line. We're stationary, not moving, so we're not going to have a very interesting line. But this would handle the case where you're actually on a mobile device moving around. Create an array of points, and we loop through the track object. So normal type for loop. And we're adding to that array a new latitude and longitude point, with the latitude and the longitude of each point from that array. And then the last thing we're doing, again, with this is a Google Maps specific thing, is we're drawing a line along this path, which is an array of latitude and longitude points. So this stuff is Google Maps specific, and this is kind of what you're referring to, talking about the geocoding API. So we have these points but they're not necessarily that interesting because they're just really long numbers and they don't mean anything to us as human beings. So we take them and put them onto map, and all of a sudden now we've got interesting data. And in this circumstance, we're using the Google Maps API. Could, of course, use the Bing mapping API or the Yahoo mapping API. Each one of them has their own API, and they take the same coordinate points and turn them into maps with points. And that's all there is to that. And on this, all this page does is onload calls that init function, which does all the stuff. And we have our div with the ID of map, and that's where the map gets inserted. Question?
Just a map question. A little surprised the need to say where it should first come down to latitude and longitude, and after that show you where you are with the red dot or bar.
So
why wouldn't that information drive where it's going to first arrive at?
Well, I think it's more that what we're doing here is we're making sure the region shown is small enough to encompass the points that we're in. So Dan hard-coded this to kind of be a box around Cambridge. I think by default, though, Google Maps will just default to a big rectangle that has the entire world on it, which could be what you want. If you're traveling from, say, Boston to, Japan, then you'd probably want a very large initial window to show the entirety of that track. In this case, what we're doing is we're hard-coding a bounding box. There's, of course, nothing preventing you from looking at your points, figuring out where your outside points are, and then padding them by a certain amount. So you say, as I go through these points, I'm going to find my northmost point, my southmost point, my western, easternmost points, and I'm going to set my bounding box to be something outside of those data points. For this simple example, though, we've hard-coded that just to make this code base as clear as possible. So yeah, there's all sorts of stuff you can do. What the defaults are will vary depending on the API.
Question about this data store, this local store we're opening.
Mm-hmm.
What has access to that, or what is it limited to?
So that's a good question. Off the top of my head, the question is, the local data store, how is access controlled and who has access to what? I believe the way that is implemented is URL specific. So there is some security protection on there. Theoretically, yeah, of course, you can see all sorts of ways for abuse if you were to have any site be able to access any other site variable. What the actual implementation details are, I can't tell you off the top of my head. I will refer you to the HTML5 documentation because I know there's been a lot of work in that area because of the various problems you have with cookies and super cookies and who can access what data and the ways to attack that stuff. So there are some access controls on there. I'm just not sure how they're actually implemented. But in this case, we can kind of trust the browser to do the right thing. I would not recommend storing secure information in there. Okay. So the geo stuff is going to become very important for the first project. If you've looked ahead a little bit, you're going to be getting information from the position of the browser, and you're going to be loading some data from API around that position. So this is going to be very important. I will post the URL because it is quite long. I will probably shorten it in just a moment and put that up. And any other questions before we wrap up?
Do you know if JSONPs is still part of HTML5?
I'm sorry, could you repeat again?
Do you know if JSONP is still part of HTML5?
JSONP?
Yeah, P, as in Paul.
As in Paul. I don't know off the top of my head. Yep.
Do you have an IDE that's for HTML? Should it have JavaScript already enabled, or that depends?
So the question is about IDEs in HTML5, which we have already mentioned. I not necessarily wouldn't recommend an IDE for this because for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that the IDEs are going to add a lot of overhead, and the HTML and JavaScript you need to do this should be relatively straightforward, and I think there's an advantage to kind of living in your text editor and being close to that code. I don't use IDEs for this myself, so your text editor of choice is up to you. I did mention before we started recording that when we actually get to Android and we actually get to iOS, our IDEs are already chosen for us, because with Android we'll be using Eclipse and with iOS we'll be using Xcode. For this project, it's, you know, whatever you think is best, and I do this sort of stuff in text editors, so I can't recommend an IDE for you. Dan, in his lecture, mentioned some JavaScript tools. I mentioned JSLint, which is at jslint.com. But there's all sorts of tools along those lines to help you clean up JavaScript or look for common errors. But the HTML5 stuff is really straightforward and relatively lightweight, so it's not too much validation to be done there. You should be pretty good to go on that. Sure.
Regarding the scheduling of sections, I realize this week is kind of irregular with that snail, but would there be, you know, this section meets the same time every week kind of thing, or is there going to be any blocks?
So the question is about the scheduling of sections, and yes, the schedule is posted, and I believe it is a regular occurring schedule. So we see that there are sections on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday. So the schedule is set, and they will be on those regular schedule. Again, unless we have another snowstorm, which, you know, I'm going to say no to because I'm done with the shoveling thing. But the schedule is set, and again, this week will be hopefully the outlier for the entire course. But I would suggest referring back to the lecture, which is taped and up, and there's a section that's taped and up, and there's another section tonight right after this that you might be interested in, although we've gone through his slides, so maybe not. Yes?
One of the information details says your CSS and JavaScript must not be minified.
Yes. So,
what does that mean?
So the question is about JavaScript or HTML5 minimization. There's the idea, we're going back to the problem that Dan and David talked about in the first week, which is making the data that has to be transferred to your mobile devices as small as possible. And there are some tools out there that minimize your JavaScript or CSS basically by doing things like removing all the comments, making all the variables one single letter, and taking out all end of lines. So it makes your JavaScript code very, very small and impossible to read. It's, you know, essentially it's as small as humanly possible. That still allows it to be, it's not even humanly possible because it's machine possible, that allows it to be interpreted correctly by the JavaScript engine. So don't use minimizers on your CSS. There's similar processes you can do for CSS by changing everything down to be as small as possible. So that's what that means. If you don't know, just don't do it and don't worry about it.
Can you start the iOS simulator by itself, or do you have to
yes.
Start Xcode and then start it?
Nope. The iOS simulator is a program by itself named iOS Space Simulator these days. It's under, I just use Spotlight. It's somewhere under Devel something, utilities, something or other. But if you have Spotlight running and you just search for iOS Simulator, it'll come up by itself. Yep.
Is the lab usually going to be more of a hands-on thing than this? Or is it section? Because it seems like this is just like a section.
Yes, again, so the question is whether labs are intended to be hands-on, more hands-on, because this week everything is screwed up. We're out of order. So yes, the intent is for them to be a little more hands-on. They're always going to be focused topically on what is covered in lecture and section as that current week. So the topics will always be relevant to what's covered during class. But generally, yes, they will not be rehashing what's going on in class. Anybody else? OK. Thanks, everybody. Have a good evening. Good luck.
Thank you.